Lady Madame. I have one job.
Right on cue.
I know. Ladies and gentlemen, madams and messieurs, welcome to a brand new Friend or Fed, the show that examines people's priors. Today we have an exceptionally interesting panel. We have returning guest Peter Canonas from the Peter Canonas Show, and Curtis Yarvin from graymirror.substack.com. Curtis, like I said in the email invite, you were the first subject of Friend or Fed over a year ago. So in many ways, you are the reason this show exists.
I wasn't on that one.
Fascinating. Yeah, fascinating.
Full circle.
So are we going to talk about Kyiv? Because, you know, you said you grew up in a Ukrainian household. Was that right? Actually speaking Ukrainian? Like you spoke that language?
No, third generation. No. My grandfather had a very, who was sort of the patriarch of the family, had a very sort of classic, tenacious, sort of a problematic relationship with his family. So I think when his parents died, he kind of made a big split. And so Orthodox religion was sort of kind of around, but we didn't really observe. And it was a big push to not speak Russian or Ukrainian or Polish in the house at all. It was only English and French. So it was
Ukrainian rather than Russian speaking family originally, or it was predominantly. Yeah.
I mean, when you get into those kind of territories, it's like, well, whizzle wazzle, what are you like?
Right. Because what I wonder every time I hear the name of this city, Kyiv, right? You know, I'm always like, you know, I'm here like Kyiv, right? And it's, to me, I don't know Russian, I don't know Ukrainian, but I sort of process this, I think, the way it sounds like a similar difference between like German and Swiss German, you know, Schweizerdeutsch, you know, like Schweizerdeutsch, I think, to a German, sounds like German being spoken by a duck who's been breathing helium. And I wonder if just sort of the feel that Russians get off of these Ukrainian names like Kyiv or Zelensky or whatever has that sort of the clownish mouth feel to it.
Well, I think what's really happening is the whole Kyiv thing, the rebranding of Kyiv is actually this is a point I wanted to get to, but it kind of ties into Joe Rogan in some ways. There seems to be like this sort of desire for transcendence past history, and the Soviets did this brilliantly. The Russians have done this what, three times now, right? Where the Soviets basically transcended their history from classic sort of Russian Empire. And created this whole new thing. Then after the fall of the Soviet Union, the Russian Federation has just basically recreated itself as well and saying, well, you know, history, right? I think with the Kyiv thing, it's like it's sort of this rebranding of Kiev, which is historical, which has historical Russian roots, which is, you know, it's in some ways the birthplace of the Kiev Rus, of the entire almost Slavic, whatever that is. And now they're rebranding it into this Kyiv thing, which is neither. It's this own new birthplace of history.
As I understand it, for most of certainly my life, Kyiv was a Russian-speaking city. And, you know, it's like when you what they're doing with this Ukraine thing is sort of so fascinating because it's like this like blast from the past of like 20th century and even 19th century, like linguistic nationalism, like, you know, the Czechs, you know, tirelessly struggling against the iron heel of the Habsburgs. Right. And, you know, and it's sort of the same thing. It's like, basically, you have these languages that are marginal languages, basically kind of rural languages, like sort of like Welsh or something. And the kind of natural path of a language, which especially has kind of fallen to sort of a lower level on the socioeconomic tier and is basically like essentially a rural language to a substantial degree. Of course, Lenin tries to bring it back for actually very similar kind of screwed up reasons, like in the 20s, right? In the 20s, there's this attempt to like have the Soviet of the nationalities or whatever. And that's coming from really sort of world progressive thought. It's coming from the same place that like diversity comes from here. But, you know, this thing of like, okay, I'm you know, this powerful foreign empire, and I'm going to stir up your linguistic minority in order to cause trouble, as though, like, you know, the Germans had been funding the Welsh and, like, you know, rebelling against the English and finding their deep Welsh identity or whatever, right? You know, and you know, this whole idea that a language means an identity, which means a nation, which means a nation state, which means a government, which means basically a projection of the British Empire onto your soil, is like so, it's so old fashioned. And you know, the idea that they can sort of be doing this again today with this incredible global PR campaign where, like, local buses and, like, I personally saw, like, buses in, like, the middle of backwater Portugal are, like, you know, Slava Ukraini, right? You know, it's this amazing thing. How do you, like, you know, I don't know. Like, I'm just like, I didn't think it was possible to be that crude in this age. And yet here it's a
slide. I'm sorry, more simple than that. I just thought it was like the establishment of an in-group marker. Like, if you pronounce it this way, you're on board with the narrative.
Oh, sure. But that's all linguistic nationalism is. Like,
but if you'll notice, to add on to that, you'll notice they don't do the same thing with Lvov, which is Polish. Like, Lvov has a Polish root because it used to be part of the Polish Lithuanian Empire.
Aren't you supposed to say Lviv?
Well, whatever. Yeah. I mean, they've done a number on Kyiv, but Lvov is still like Lvov or Lviv or whatever you want to, you want to. That one's they don't.
Yeah, because it does need to be across the board. You just establish that one.
And yeah, I mean, because what you're doing with these sort of acts of linguistic dominance is you're just alphaing the whole population. And so if you basically live in a city and then, you know, like Estonia had been part of the, say what you want about the Stalin, Estonia had been part of the Soviet Union for basically 40 years at the time of the fall of the Soviet Union, and in 20-30% at least of the people there are Russian. And so basically when they say, hey, your street signs aren't in your own language, you're going to have to learn Estonian, which is this like thing that like makes like Finnish look like baby English or something, you know, in order to keep your job and your passport, right? This way of like expressing dominance it's sort of so emotionally powerful. It's like, imagine, you know, here's sort of a story I tell. Please don't take this as a proposal. Okay, this is a thought experiment. But like, here's my thought experiment. So, you know, sometimes Republicans will ask me, what do we need to do to beat the Democrats? How can we finally own the libs? And I'm like, guys, here is one simple policy you can take. Doesn't hurt anyone. Purely symbolic. You know, but if you do this, you will have owned the libs. You will have totally beaten the Democrats. And they're like, what? And I'm like, it's very simple. Take every street in the United States and name for Martin Luther King and name it after Robert E. Lee instead. And of course, you're like, your Republican will be like, well, what good would that do? Like, how would that help? Right. Well, no, it's not going to help. It's basically showing that you can do that is showing that you have walked all over every liberal in the country. And basically power itself, which is the power that names streets, power cares about your concerns, which is that, you know, this great American Robert E. Lee be honored. And whereas power has decided that Martin Luther King was a plagiarizing, cheating communist, right? And so by sort of enforcing that in the form of these street name changes, you basically show most people are sort of not really deep in their convictions. They want to go with the winning side. And when you basically show, no, we're going to actually change the street names. Yeah, there's some budget costs and like paint and green paint and whatever. We're going to do this. Then, you know, you're basically showing every amoral aspiring young person in the world which shoe, you know, power's foot is in.
Yeah, it's the right wing equivalent of rainbow crosswalks.
Exactly. Stars and bars crosswalks, you know. And the thing is, you're basically saying, I'm going to take the thing that you ritually believe in. I mean, literally, we have now a legal system where actually, you know, the pride flag, you were charged with political crimes for burning a pride flag, but you can burn an American flag, no problem. Right. You know, and when you see that, you see, I mean, people used to get in real legal trouble for burning American flags back in the 60s. Right. You know, and when you see basically that's just the kind of demonstration of where power is, okay, it's a mistake to say that sort of changing it symbolically will have that effect. But yeah, actually, if you don't have the power to change all those crosswalks and all those street names and all those flags in that way, you don't have the power, period. And like, that's a good way of defining the level of power you need to get to beat these people.
Yeah. Is that to show you where we're at right now? If that's what's going on is the opposite.
Yeah. I don't know. What do you think, Pete?
I just don't ever remember having chicken Kiev.
I'll tell you a funny story.
You should try the turkey Lvov. It's fantastic out here.
I'll tell you a funny story I heard about this Ukrainian language thing from a friend of a friend who was a Ukrainian Jew, and he emigrated as like a young teenager with his family, you know, and in the mid-90s, by which time this Ukrainianization thing had already been going on. I mean, these were just arbitrary administrative, you know, definitions that Stalin sort of created to get more seats at the United Nations, right? You know, and then they get dismembered by Washington, you know, as a way of winning the Cold War. But like, come on, man, this was part of Russia. And the story is that the USSR had broken apart, and this guy with his family had to emigrate, or they were wanted to emigrate, and they were Jews, because they're Jews, and the Jews in, at least since Yiddish was no longer a thing, the Jews in the Ukraine always spoke Russian, right? They're never Ukrainian speaking Jews. That's weird, right? And the, like, because it's a language of peasants, and not just peasants, but like Goy peasants, right? You know, well,
no Ukrainian spoke Ukrainian. The only language enclaves were basically in Toronto, Chicago, and a few other places, like Winnipeg. So,
right,
actually had to import people over to Ukraine after 91 to teach Ukrainians how to speak Ukrainian. Because of Catherine the Great. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's like it was practically a dead language, but it gets resurrected as the language of this like corrupt regime building project, right? And which we now know as I guess without the thought, we now know as Ukraine, right? And so anyway, this guy's dad has to get a Ukrainian passport in order to emigrate, and so in order to get a Ukrainian passport, needs to pass a Ukrainian language test, which is like basically asking you if you wanted to get a passport to leave America to get a language test in like Gula or something, right? You know, the language Clarence Thomas was gonna, like Haitian Creole, Jamaican English, I don't know, something really. And I'm sure it sounds like kind of like regular normal human speech, but very cringe. But it's also kind of focused on the simple lives of the simple people who speak it. So, you know, this guy's dad is reading this test, and he's like, you know, encounters the question, what is the Ukrainian word for helicopter? And he's like, you know, I know the Ukrainian word for plow. I even know the Ukrainian word for tractor, for horse, I know, for goose, I know. But it's like being asked to say, how do you say genome sequencer in like Jamaican, right? You know, so this is the clown show that everyone around the world is supposed to get as excited about as climate change. And maybe it's even supplanted climate change in some people's minds, and so they're totally not worrying that the world is going to get, you know, 1.5 degrees warmer in the next 30 years, which I can tell you, I'm just turning 50, is far from my biggest worry about the next 30 years. And they're focused on this Ukraine thing. It's just like, and it's so weird and sick, because it's like, you know, you're just like into this war. You're just like, you're on your, well on your way to killing 500,000 people. And it's like glorious. It's like good TV. It gets you like a hard on when you renew your New York Times subscription. Right. How do you feel? Is that too cynical for you? Do you?
No, not at all. I mean, look, I said from the very, we've been following this war from the very beginning. I described myself as a Ukrainian nationalist, for the better or for worse, since 91, mostly because I was raised to hate the Russians, like, you know,
right,
that's yeah, a pretty standard thing. And, mm-hmm, and as sure, I progressed as I got older, and it, you know, I would say that I'm an armchair historian in terms of Russian, especially Ukraine and Poland. Mm-hmm. And when this war broke out, I said from the very start, this is a disaster. Like, there is the time for the U.S. or the West to intervene would have been in 2004 with Yushchenko and the color revolution there. This whole trying to rearm Ukraine over the pandemic and stuff, that was an absolute disaster, and has shown. The idea of Ukrainian sovereignty is now off the table, and that was something that was a very bitter pill to swallow, but necessary for me. And I think there's a whole bunch of other things that have happened over the last few years that have kind of opened my eyes. Not to shine your shoes too much, Curtis, but you were integral in that. You know, when you take one red pill and all of a sudden you start taking them all. And when you start to question these narratives and you start to see that the idea of Ukrainian sovereignty was always a lie, that this is always going to come down to either it being a suburb of Poland or falling back into the Russian Federation. And actually, probably the best case scenario for the Ukraine, or for the majority of it, would be to be part of Russia, like officially, for all the way from Odessa to Kiev or Kyiv or whatever the fuck you want to call it. And then let the rest carve it off the rest to Poland, and then that's going to be it. Like, that's why I see this is the end result. Keep in mind also, sorry, I'll finish this thought. Yeah. Keep in mind also that the Ukraine had been designated Plan 2030 of the EU is to make Ukraine the breadbasket of Europe, not just the East. What they're doing explains what they're doing in Holland with the Dutch farmers. The big plan was to do a lot of stuff in Ukraine, mostly because of the fertilizer crisis that we're about to experience in all over the globe. Russia is the number one holder of nitrous fertilizer. Morocco, for some reason, has the number one supplier of the other form.
And in Ukraine, you have the black earth, and you barely need fertilizer.
Exactly. So that's what they're going to war over. This is actually a war over shit.
Ironically, this takes us in a different, historical direction. But
we'll get to Joe Rogan sometimes, folks. Don't worry. We'll get to Joe Rogan. There is a circle back in here. And Pete, jump in anytime.
First Hitler. So when Hitler, of course, invades the Ukraine, and you probably know.
Curtis, just to put this out here. If this devolves into a live watch of Hitler Lives, I'll be happy with that. I will consider that
my joke. You know, my joke. Do you know, six feet away from me, I have a bunch of medals from World War II, but I actually have a crim shield, an actual crim shield from any German who served in the Ukrainian campaign 41 to 42 got one.
Wow. Got it. So the thing is that when, I think that, there's this myth that it's like when the Germans in Nuremberg are charged with sort of two great crimes. One of them is the murder of the Jews, which is absolutely true, they did commit, and the other is plotting to take over the world, which they're almost entirely innocent of. And what they were not entirely innocent of, and sort of what reflects the kind of deeper kind of German military infrastructure under, this whole like Nazi romantic, like blood and soil, Lebensraum stuff, what's in the minds of the like sincere, like military planners in Germany, the kind of people who fought World War I, not like freaks like Hitler, is basically the fact that Germany is not food self-sufficient. I mean, obviously Hitler knew this too, but like, that's not the way he marketed it. Germany only produced like 60% of its calories. So effectively, if the, area of Eastern Europe to Germany's east is a satellite of Britain, then Britain can just squeeze Germany's balls the way it did in 1919 and just starve Germany, and Germany can never be sovereign. And so, you're sort of seeing what really reflects this invasion of the East is a sort of very concrete desire by the German state to basically get what it needs to be sovereign. And of course, the agricultural resources of the Ukraine are like a big part of that. And yeah, so, yeah, so. There's, yeah. I mean, you know,
just to speak to the authenticity of my co-host on this topic, he's the only person that I remember actually bitching about Putin pre-2016.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's so not he's, a, no, I mean, Putin is pretty much what the West thinks he is. Right. You know, but he's also, but the Ukrainian regime is pretty much not what the average NPR listener thinks it is. And like, you know, especially seeing just the just incredible brazenness of the corruption there that really, you know, sort of embroiled significant American figures. And you're just like, that was not a well-functioning state. That was not, is not. And like, I think you can correct me if I'm wrong, but like, I think there are aspects, even before this disastrous war, there were aspects that were very like, you know, less like Russia in the Putin era and more like Russia in the Yeltsin era. And I don't think anyone thinks of Russia in the Yeltsin era as a success.
It's a very difficult situation. I mean, to give Putin any kind of his dues, I mean, he's been dealing with, yeah, post-Yeltsin, post-Cold War, collapse of the Soviet Union, massive corruption, which he had to wrestle with and get under control, depending on who you listen to. And again, the hardest part with all this stuff, and this is, well, maybe I'll try to tie this back into Rogan, is that inputs and outputs here are getting confused. So, and deliberately so, I think, by everybody. I don't think Russia wants anyone to really know what's going on in Russia. It is, mm-hmm. That doesn't play into their hand. It, you know, when I've always heard Western thought leaders try to say that Russia's just ruled by a bunch of oligarchs. I mean, yes, that is true and is also not true. Putin is not Stalin.
Very true.
He's at best he's a mafia lawyer, and that's kind of always been his role. It's why he always turns to law, be it international or otherwise. He's very savvy at knowing how to apply pressure and get leverage, and that's been shown. Like, the stuff he's been able to do in what 25 years or so is pretty damn good, all considering, for Russia. But it's not going to be him who continues it on. The two interesting things that have come out of this war now is, well, maybe three, is that the sanctions didn't work, and the Russians sidestepped the sanctions by having an entirely parallel economic model already set up to kind of deal with it, and that didn't happen overnight. Like, they had that planned over 8 years. Relationships with the BRICS nations is something to really to keep an eye on, and now Russia's now, because of this war, now has the most powerful military in the world in terms of experience. Anything they send, any ground forces send in to attack that Russian force is going to get chewed up, period. Like, they have more battle experience now than any other major standing army in the world. So that's major.
That is something really, you know, I was talking to a Ukraine stan the other day, kind of in sort of somewhat drifting in the somewhat Spartan pro-Ukrainian direction, and he was emphasizing sort of the Spartan nation of the Ukrainians that's been created. And I guess, you know, this, some of that is a real, you know, war is the health of the state, so these should be like healthy states. It's kind of cool to see this like battle trained force, you know, emerge as a result of, you know, so much suffering. But I think the real, I mean, especially considering like what's in the news now, I think the question we should really focus on this stream
is Joe Rogan a friend?
Rogan, Rogan or Prigozhin separated at birth?
Very similar look, actually. You know,
they both have presence. They both have charisma. You could imagine Prigozhin doing a talk show. You totally see it. Prigozhin, and what is he up to now?
The Prigozhin experience. Yeah,
the Prigozhin experience. You know, the Spotify could license it. Segue into the Joe Rogan experience and the Prigozhin experience. What is Dugan he up to now? Time, like,
Dugan, have you done DMT? Have you tried DMT?
You're kind of mixing them. What is he up to now? What is this Prigozhin stunt? What is this crazy thing I read about?
I honestly, now he's challenging the defense minister. He's basically the news is calling it a coup against the Russian defense minister. I look at that as a giant soap opera. I don't believe anything out of anyone. The only thing I honestly believe, Curtis, at this point is maps. This is the thing I've always turned to people who've been telling me that this war is going to be over and the plucky Ukrainians are going to win this thing and blow everything out of the water and all this stuff. I say, look, here's the map, right? Now you tell me how this red area that keeps advancing into this blue area is losing. You explain that to me and I will listen. I'm all for it. I want less Ukrainians dying. That's my objective. That's what I would like to see. Less people who look like me dying for nothing.
So we can
figure that out. I'm all for it. But
it's strange. It's strange that the supporter of the Ukrainian nation would have that perspective. That's a really weird.
Guys, he's just carrying water for Trump.
Did you see Wagner Best in Hell, the movie they made?
No.
Oh my God, that's so worth seeing. It's so good. It's really, really good. It's actually a really good war film, believe it or not. Like, it's a scripted feature film about urban warfare in, like, you know, Popasna, I think. And it's just like everyone you see on the screen is like an actual mercenary. And that sounds like
fun. I mean, Wagner is basically the French Foreign Legion. I mean, that's right. the way to look at it. There are foreigners in Wagner. How are we pronouncing that now? Is that Kiev now? Is that
Wagner?
Wagner. Yeah. But yeah, it's basically the French Foreign Legion of. Now the interesting thing will come out of it, because I think the person who will succeed Putin is not going to be an oligarch or another lawyer. It's going to be a general, someone who can get me out of that war. So I think that's most likely, because they're going to have to be on a war footing for the next 25 to God knows how many years, right?
Sure. It's straight up trench warfare there. I mean, you know, I feel like there are probably ways in which sort of more better and bigger clouds of FPVs could kind of overwhelm this like trench warfare structure. But, you know, because there's sort of a gap, like it seems to me that somewhere between these like consumer UAVs and these like very high cost, you know, very one-off defense UAVs, there's a storm, you know, you've seen these clouds of Dragon, you know, drones over China doing a dragon dance with like thousands of drones, right? Just take those things, put some TNT on them and like make them attack. And probably these forces have trouble defending themselves against that. But that technology isn't really available at, you know, now. And so what we're seeing is basically not really super different from a World War One or World War Two battlefield. Like, and it's ugly out there. It's not, you know.
Let's transition here, because we're at the 30-minute mark and we haven't even
the chat's yet. Having their own debate.
I mentioned. I know.
No, that's fine. It's good. And look, this show is based around two concepts: clickbait and free-willing discussion. I put no limitations on where we can go. Let's get
back to Rogan and Prigozhin.
Let's start with Rogan, Pete. Any first initial thoughts on Joe Rogan? You know how the show works. Definitionally, friend is anyone who's allying themselves or giving the dissident right new ideas, concepts, something to go with, some sort of positioning, or at least not burying us. And a Fed is everyone who's not doing that. Of course, you can always be a Fed but not be on the payroll. Quite often what people who are basically doing the Fed's work for them without being paid is kind of the worst Fed of all. Pete, any initial thoughts on Joe Rogan?
Well, his podcast has been two things, but at different times. I mean, it started out just as a bro show. We would talk about UFC, stuff like that. He would talk about how the moon landing was faked and things like that. Then all of a sudden, Neil deGrasse Tyson comes on the show and it gets serious, and he can get like any interview he wants in the world. Up until this point, he's just had these UFC guys on. DeGrasse Tyson comes on, boom, everything changes.
Was it Neil deGrasse Tyson which was the inflection point?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything changed. And then he, you know, he had a bunch of serious conversations. Then there were a couple conversations through the Trump presidency. There were some conversations he had that were troubling to me. He had Snowden on twice and just basically allowed Snowden to give the speech that he always gives over Zoom to like the Free State Project and people like that. Didn't ask him hardly any questions. And it's just like, okay, what? And Snowden's giving information, talking about different apps and stuff like that. It was just kind of weird. And he also has a CIA agent, Mike Baker, on all the time. And he never questions. He never like I remember when he had Larry Sharp, who's a guy, a great guy. I mean, one of the nicest people you ever meet in New York, libertarian, ran for governor. When he had him on, it was just, oh, you want, you think schools should be privatized? And then just is hammering him. When the CIA guy comes on, that's it. Just talk, give your speech. I'll be like, yeah, that's crazy, man. Yeah, that's like every response to it. Through the COVID stuff, you know, he had some interesting people on. He had Dr. Robert Malone on, let him talk. And it seems like, and here I'm just going to go complete conspiracy theory. It seems like as soon as Lex Fridman came on the scene, Lex Fridman got all of the old Joe Rogan kind of interviews that Joe Rogan would get. And Joe Rogan went back to like UFC kind of stuff, Dave Mustaine, you know, having guys like that on. And, you know, every once in a while he has something, you know, like having Robert, you know, RFK Jr. on. But yeah, it seems like he just passed it off to Lex Fridman, who is not even human. And the numbers he gets on YouTube are completely fake. Mm-hmm. Nobody, I mean, how could anybody listen to that guy? There's nothing compelling about the guy.
Well, are you trying to tell me that Curtis Yarvin's biggest fan, which Weinstein brother is? It's not
Eric.
Is Eric?
Eric
Yarvin's Curtis's biggest fan. Biggest fan. You're trying to tell me he's not barn burning and bringing in millions of views? Come on.
You don't all subscribe to the portal?
I think Weinstein did good work through COVID.
Yeah.
Brett.
Yeah, sorry. I have management things. Can I take a 1 minute break from this and go down and deal with some moving people?
Sure. Yeah.
All right. Happens all the time.
So I think there's definitely, I don't think anyone failed to notice that what you just brought up, Pete, that split between Rogan 1 and Rogan 2. And I feel like now we're kind of on to Rogan 3. Mm-hmm. My favorite, of course, was Rogan 1, because I'm like, give me the bro conspiracies. That's my bag. I can do that all day long. Then he definitely got boringer after being legitimized. To some degree.
The first episode that really did it for me was the first time he had Snowden on. It was so obvious that Snowden was there to deliver a message uninterrupted.
What is the Snowden message? I've never been able to comprehend what the hell his deal is.
Yeah, it's funny. I saw someone mention Monica Perez in the chat. Monica Perez, I sent it to Monica Perez. I said, watch this and we're going to do an episode on it. And she watched it and she's like, we have to do an episode on this. And it was just like he gave a friggin' speech, but he didn't really say anything. He didn't say anything that, like, I mean, he had given, like, 3 years before that, he had spoken to the Free State Project via Zoom. It was basically the same exact speech.
Mm-hmm. No, the guy's a one-trick pony. I just can't figure out what the trick is.
I don't trust the government spying on you. I don't trust anyone connected to Glenn Greenwald at all. Like, if you have 6 degrees of separation to Glenn Greenwald, I'm eyeing you suspicion, because that man glows like a freaking torch, in my opinion. Like,
I mean, he's an old lawyer. I mean, yeah,
sure.
Yeah,
he just keeps popping up in places, and you're like, how did you just pop up seemingly there? Like, how are you just showing up in places spontaneously? And seemingly, you know, oppressed and being all oppressed, but yet getting all these amazing stories and being connected to all these people at these seemingly random but good times. It's at some point coincidences kind of bear themselves out. So, you know, okay, where do we want to take this? I want to kind of wait for Curtis to get back on, because I think when we're looking at Rogan, he's almost like the king of the hobbits. And I have an idea that he's sort of like 1995 personified, which is something I think Curtis can get, can chew into. But I think, you know, with Rogan, it's going through all that stuff over the last month, he's kind of like exactly that, that inflection point of the cathedral, what we were always talking about with the Fed, is like, I don't believe he's on the Fed payroll. I don't think that he's being controlled per se. But yeah, with the Mike Baker connection, it's like, as soon as you see that coming on, you're like, you're feeding.
It's the same thing with Kennedy on Fox Business.
Right.
She would have Mike Baker on all the time. And I'm like, oh, she's a libertarian. Oh, okay, sure. She's a libertarian. Okay. Yeah. And then, like, as soon as somebody would say anything dissident, anything, I would just, nope.
Can't do it.
Cut it off.
No. What I think is really happening is that a lot of these people, like even from Tucker Carlson, when we did the Tucker Carlson Friend or Fed, which is the big, my resting point is that I believe he's a pressure valve, and what we need is a pressure washer. But these pressure valves of conversation where people come on and they say all these things, you know, with the Kennedy interview, right? And this whole thing about the vaccines and nothing's happening. And I don't expect anything to happen.
Right.
Just a few months ago, there was a big, here comes Curtis. There was he had a guy on who's talking about, you know, slave mines in Africa for lithium. So that means your cell phone is caked in blood. And that was a big thing on Twitter for a week. And then boom, nothing happened. Like, they didn't even get a congressional hearing. Like, sorry, Kurt, we're talking about Joe Rogan being almost a pressure valve instead of a pressure washer. That we need. It's looking at influence almost versus impact. And quite often you'll have these big stories that break on Rogan that catch the media narrative, is a big deal. And then just nothing happens.
But is nothing happening vis-a-vis this Hotez thing? Or
yeah, no, nothing. Like, you can't hurt these people in this way. And like, basically believing that you can hurt these people in this way sort of kind of comes out of this belief in like sort of independent, responsible. It's like, wow, you know, if we just show that like Hunter Biden was actually giving money, and we know, of course, that this, you know, this is not true. This is his own independent business deals. But if we could just show that like Hunter Biden was giving money to his dad, you know, like, and the whole thing would break wide open. I'm like, no, it wouldn't. Like, you know, and you can never show that, because basically these people will always get like every incentive in the system. Every procedural actor in the process wants to give Hunter Biden a slap on the wrist and wants to sentence Donald Trump for life imprisonment for taking two packets of sugar instead of one, you know, and like, that's so deeply built into the system. And so when you're just like, if we could only expose it, you're like one of these like poor Soviet saps in like, you know, 1935, who's like, if only Stalin knew, right? You know, and instead of if only Stalin knew, it's like, it's if only like the people knew, or the,
well, like, to that point, Solzhenitsyn brings out Gulag Archipelago in what, 19... book is published 60. Late 60s, maybe even early 70s in France, because I think there was the first publication. Mm-hmm. Wildly promoted, like everyone in the West has a copy of this book, has access to this book in their given language. This is not secret, this is not conspiracy, whatever stuff. And what happened? Nothing.
Like, well, I mean, yeah. I mean, you have a general sort of gradual sundering between the liberals of the, like,
Foucault had to stop calling himself a communist.
You have this split between Western progressivism and Eastern progressivism, but it's still like, this is a family relationship. These things are cousins, right? And, you know, just because they sort of split doesn't make them, it's just like, hey, you know, the Chinese communism and Soviet communism also split, but they were still both communism, right? And so you have this gradual kind of falling out of love, but at the same time, I mean, frickin' Teddy Kennedy is still like basically back channeling with the KGB about, I forget whether it was the 76 or the 80 election, you know, and like the how do we work together on this, comrades, right? You know, talk about like Russian interference. Like he's like sending his like best friend Gene Tunney over there on like secret missions to talk to the KGB about how to like work together to get the right result out of the 1976 American election, right? You know, and
the president of the WWF during the 1980s, really
different Gene Tunney. You know, and different, sadly. But the like, so sort of when you go back to like, you know, I don't know, I have to confess something here, which is that I'm on this podcast to talk about Joe Rogan, and I don't know Joe Rogan, and I've never actually listen to Joe Rogan, but that's okay, because you know we can refer this to Eric Weinstein, and I don't know Eric Weinstein either.
Well, but no, but here's the thing.
But here's the, you know, the that general, like the real question is sort of that general kind of intellectual dark web vibe, and the thing is, there's sort of ultimately there's a kind of, I feel that everyone who kind of ventures into that water is like, you know, they've gone into like this, there's this beach that they're at, and they know that the beach is shark infested. They know it's, you know, just huge man-eating sharks patrol the shores. But like, you know, can you wade there? Can you get your feet wet? You know, a little few drops get on you, you're not going to be eaten by a shark. And then you're like, I went swimming. And someone else was like, well, I went swimming. And what he means is he was up into his ankles. But as soon as you're up into your ankles, you kind of have, you're like, why not the knees? Why couldn't I go in all, I mean, surely there's not sharks in knee deep water. Water is very murky, you know? And so there's a sort of desire to like swim in these like really wild, dangerous, disturbing like waters of deep historical truth. And then there's also this kind of all, you know, countervailing desire not to to get eaten by a fucking shark. And so someone like Rogan, sort of as tough as he is, kind of has to, he walks that line in interesting ways. And I don't think I certainly don't think Rogan, it doesn't feel like he's sort of conscious that that's what he's doing. It's sort of this more like unconscious kind of like, I don't like go there kind of thought self-policing thing, which is really obvious to those of us who basically, you know, have been like, you know, doing freestyle, you know, out in the middle of the bay, you know, for years, right? You know, is like, come on in, the water's fine, I guess it's full of sharks, whatever, like, you know. and the
sharks are great.
The sharks are great, you know, every once in a while, but one of us gets taken, but it's worth it to be free, yeah. Right? And someone like Rogan, who's standing on in the shallows with his $50 million Spotify contract or whatever, I mean, how much is he making from Spotify 100, now?
105 years?
200. Damn. Actually, I think it's actually closer to 200 million over three years.
I gotta get better at this business.
Well, right? Jason, you know? Jason mentioned me before the show something I thought that was kind of apt, which was that Jogan and sort of this whole genre, like you said, the IDW represents a yearning to go back to the pre-9/11 innocence.
It's
right?
Very much the sort of comforting innocence of the 90s, where you like you sort of never imagined, like even when, you know, it's funny, like even I'm writing all this stuff in like, you know, the aughts, right? And it's a still kind of an abstraction to me. I'm like, yes, at a certain intellectual level, this is sort of a thought control state, but I'm still kind of surprised when, you know, it used to be, yeah, you could post anything on Blogger. Like Blogger would like censor you for bad ideas. That's so weird, right? And now it's basically just like, you know, the menace of misinformation, you know, it's like, how are, is your service, you know, adapted to prevent misinformation, citizen, you know, and you're just like, what, like, how did I like stumble into this Orwell fever dream? Oh, right. I sort of knew it was there all along, but like seeing the, like the tangible nature of that and so when you look at basically someone like Rogan, or even, you know, someone like these intellectual dark web fellows, is that the whole thing? I don't know. But it's like you're sort of responding to this desire to be like, yes, I'm one who swims with sharks.
while not getting your shirt wet, you know, and
right. That does, right. Does he kind of represent that, the idea that you, because he at least pretends
these
to have
people
these
are
conversations
gateway drugs.
And
yeah,
he gets away with it, right?
These people,
so is
are
it there to kind
drugs.
Of placate us of like, oh yeah, you can talk about shit and not get destroyed.
Yeah, it's which hard is... to like, yeah, because obviously there's a lot of directions that, you know, first of all, I mean, the thing about someone like Rogan is, number one, like, you know, I think he'd be much more effective if somewhere with that $100-200 million, he basically is like, okay, I'm going to take my $100 million. It's a lot of money. It's really a lot of money. And I'm going to go out, and rather than just doing sort of, well, do you know the George Best story? George Best was a soccer player in the UK in the 60s or 70s, and he led a famously exciting life. And at one point, a reporter asked Best, you know, and then he went broke after his, you know, like amazing career starring for England, right? And a journalist asked him, the journalist is like, you know, Mr. Best, you know, what happened to the money? And Best was like, well, some of it I spent on women, and some of it I spent on drugs, and some of it I spent on cars, and the rest I wasted. And absolute genius right there. Yeah, I don't know. Where were we?
Please go ahead.
Remind me before my best anecdote.
Go, Pete.
Oh, the basically what the Joe Rogan show is, what all of these shows are, any IDW.
Oh, right. I remember my idea now.
Is it's just liberalism.
It's true liberalism. It's like sort of, it's like honest liberalism in a way, but it's also, it has this sort of scared component. I mean, the thing I was about to say after my George Best idea was that maybe you should take some of this money and basically hire some really, really good fact checkers, like some people that aren't like quote fact checkers, like the some people that are just like, you know what, I'm going to go find out if this is true. And if it's true that there was no Holocaust and Hitler was just operating a giant exercise program in the East or something, I'm going to say that. I won't be afraid of saying it, but I guess what, that's not the true thing that you're going to find, but you're going to find many other true things. And more importantly, when you're someone like Rogan, what's really, I think he doesn't understand the cost of as an entertainer is like, it devalues your power and what you can do so much anytime you are wrong. And I feel like basically Rogan is a very smart guy with a lot of common sense. I feel like he shoots from the hip occasionally. And basically someone with his power of communication skills and kind of general acumen and common sense was basically supplemented by like this like vast battalion of nerds behind the scenes, like really people who should not be on TV, probably whose voice should not even be heard by anything but other nerds. But like, you know, whatever's going on with vaccines and whatever Joe wants to say about vaccines should be the result of like a tame stable of like super nerds like that. It should not be the result of like what he had for breakfast.
But at the same time, the super nerds are all corrupted as well. Like,
hiring these people is a very hard problem, right? You know, because the thing is, you're hiring, but you know, there's a pretty large pool. There's a lot of nerds in the world. There's a large pool to select from, right? And so actually finding someone who has, finding basically a staff of people who are just like, no, I'm going to make sure that everything Joe says is true. And like what I think really just create a level of like strength there that's like beyond what you can imagine.
Well, that would be that's what the news was supposed to be,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Some world. Well, so it would be a reinvention, a reinvention of critical of accurate
it's,
information.
It's a reinvention.
He's got his kind of version of that where he's trying to do the I forget what he called it, something previously. I'm not complimenting it.
Sure.
I'm saying it's a
sure. Thing. I mean, the problem is that basically the standards.
It's like a Twitter. What do they call that? The community
journalism.
The same
journalism.
Thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Journalism. Right.
Journalism.
Imagine that.
Right. You know, and
employing
and the problem
people
is,
to go find the facts. Yeah,
the problem is the standard of journalism is just so debased by these, you know, this terrible age that we're in, that sort of people feel that they're like, okay, well, I don't, you know. Joe's probably like, I like to tell the truth. Obviously, I'm not the New York Times. I don't have to be like as like diligent as the New York. Like, I'm like, dude, like you have to be 10 times as diligent as the New York Times. Like, you right. actually, the place above the New York Times has been vacated by the New York Times, you know, in pursuit of the holy click. If you can actually get above that, you know, you can get people to trust you so deeply on the basis of actually being trustworthy, and you can build, you really, Rogan should be able to build the kind of bond with people that they had with Walter Cronkite. And, you know, they had that bond with Walter Cronkite for two reasons. One is that it was the 50s and they were very, very gullible. And, you know, the other was that Cronkite had this amazing kind of regime behind him that was very capable, although it did lie a lot. And like, I think it's possible to establish Walter Cronkite levels of trust in an honest way by just being right.
Well, that's well, why, sorry, this, that's I, what I wonder if Rogan is being propped up as a bulwark against that. Because I've had this thought that I haven't been able to sort of refine or get rid of, which is, so when the internet started, it was this threat because we're going to have all the information. We're going to have access to the libraries of the world will be at your fingertips, and everything will just be the new enlightenment. And then whatever sort of the 90s were, that libertarian kind of free for all, which was great. Mm-hmm. And we want to get back there. And I feel like especially during COVID, what's kind of been done is just this massive information dump to drown at any possibility of sifting through it. It's like, let's just push everything so much at everybody that you're basically demoralized. Trust the expert.
If you pump sewage and pristine clear well water into the same cistern, the sewage overtakes the well water, not the other way around.
A little bit of sewage, it really
you can fuck it up. So is you've been
in the
there
third
as
world? I just don't like. Yeah, I mean, I sort of. Like most of your feds are like this, right? You know, it's like, I think when you find someone occupying that niche, it's sort of, you know, the niche of like, you know, I mean, Tucker has some of the same issues. Like Tucker's a little more mainstream, he's a little more boomery. He's still excellent. But if I had a criticism of him, I would say that he sort of follows his readers a little too much. And, you know, setting the standard of, anytime you're sort of creating that kind of content and you have a bid for that level of Walter Cronkite trust, and ultimately I think that level of trust and loyalty in an alternative force is the only way to change the system, right? You know, when you're building that kind of confidence, you're building something that's hugely important. It should be an institution. It should be larger than you as a mere individual. And like, you know, that institution has to achieve a level of like honor, a level of feeling. It's like, you know, one of the things I'll, you know, this is kind of a joke, but it's kind of not a joke, that I'll say to people who are doing like some kind of any kind of new media or publishing thing. I'm like, basically, your ambitions as a media organization should be to be the state media organization of the next regime. And, you know, does that mean that this is a future that's going to happen and you'll be like the TASS of, you know, the American Empire or something? No, not necessarily. But the thing is that if you're, you know, what of course comes with that position is this tremendous need for credibility. And like to say that I'm actually, I mean, the New York Times is basically the state media. It's the official gazette of our regime, all the news that's fit to print. Right. And so if you're
we had the same in Canada. We had the CBC, and Jason can vouch for this, until the aughts, they managed to hold some amount of credibility by being balanced, and they fit that mold exactly.
The word credibility is
that's gone now
because it can mean either you know, veritability or credence. I would say that, you know, Walter Cronkite had a lot of credence. I don't know how much credibility he had. I think you could actually do a very fun history project by going back and looking at a year's worth of Walter Cronkite broadcasts and being like, what is this sweet, sweet man lying to you about? You know, and he wouldn't be the one inventing the lies, of course. He's just forwarding them on. So yeah, it's like the possibilities when you're getting out of this state is like, I want, you know, I think someone like Joe can be more trustworthy than
well, so if I could jump in with an idea, there's, yeah. I don't know if you, I think Pete, I've heard you mention, and I know I've mentioned them a ton of times. There's a podcast called The No Agenda Show. And this is Adam Curry. He's the guy who started podcasting. And something like what you're talking about has kind of happened organically with what they're doing, because their reach, they've got about 1 million listeners, and they've got people all in every different field who interact organically with them and will call them on their bullshit if they're wrong. Right. So they go over the news. They try to do it as unbiased as possible. And then if they're, you know, that old sort of saying is like, whenever the news talks about something that you're familiar with,
right,
you can spot the wrong, that but then you don't notice in the other topics.
Crichton's.
Yeah, but I'm
being unbiased. They get that organically because they have people in each sort of field, whatever topic they're covering, who will write in during the donation segment and be like, yeah, you're mostly right, but you were kind of wrong there. And so maybe Rogan doesn't even have to be that, because that kind of already came about organically in other forums.
Yeah. That's, I mean, you know, that there's a lot of ways to build. I mean, even community notes on Twitter isn't that bad, right? You know, there's a lot of ways to build, you know, a truth machine when this starts getting into, you know, really, really difficult truths that can be harder. Sorry, I'm managing a like semi move now. But you know, you actually, when you start sort of getting really like into the more difficult content, it's like how does like community notes sort of wade into like the 1350 question, right? You know, or like the that's a hard, you know.
We got to get Steve Saylor gets his own
No, Steve should be a master of like community notes. And then you get stuff that's sort of just like intensely frame breaking, like this. There was this Nature paper on human origins that just came out, written up fairly well in the New York Times, but basically. Well, there was a sort of simpler version of it that came out in Science 3 years ago. This paper came out in early COVID, and it was basically about someone had done various genomic analysis of human origins. And I think the last, basically they concluded that African populations have something like up to 20% admixture from something that lived only in Africa that was like the African version of the Neanderthals, like, and you're just reading this like really like that would not be described as sapiens, right? You know, and you're reading this freaking abstract in Science, right? It's in Science, it's a news magazine, it's about science.
You've
probably heard of it, right? You know, and I fucking love Science, right? You know, and you're reading this thing, and like every sentence in the abstract, I feel like could be, you could basically take that sentence and on the front of the sentence you could stick a phrase like confirming the remarkable early insights of my uncle Roy. And
Thanksgiving was lit.
Thanksgiving was lit, right? When Uncle Roy finally brought out his copy of Science magazine, right? Literally, I mean, Dervasla 2020, like read the abstract. I'm not kidding, right? You know, and so you have this problem in which the whole like Anglo-American tradition is its own thing, and it's like sort of roamed in a way like fairly distant from sort of historical perspectives, which other eras found very obvious, I guess I would say. Hmm. And so the, like, how, you know, when you're talking about a sort of information system with the power to, like, correct Joe Rogan about vaccines or whatever,
is there a more powerful information system than Rogan currently? What would be that thing that would correct him? Say he were to actually take a side and not just be the one saying, hey, let's debate.
Yeah, he would basically have to be like, okay, I'm going to take my $200 million and instead of plowing it into money, women, and cars or whatever he prefers to spend it on, he'd have to basically say, okay, I'm really great at communicating the truth. I'm really great at finding the truth, but I'm also kind of small time when I just use my common sense on that. And, you know, the, one sec. You know, and I think that there's a lot of, you know, the sort of the lack of the ambition. Imagine, you know, Joe Rogan is literally like this, the Baghdad Bob of the next regime, right? You know, he's the guy that has to come out and explain why the leader has done what he's done. What's going on? He has to be completely trusted and completely true. And
so no Michael Malice for press secretary.
and so just think about, like, if you gave Joe Rogan that kind of budget to basically find the damn truth about everything, rather than just having this sort of Norman Rockwell idea of like, oh, it's everybody's opinion, you know, free debate among opinions, like, settles the truth. No, man, like, shit is true or it's not true. And, you know, there are many cases in which the truth will be found because simply nobody who believes in it will not be found because nobody who believes in it is in your audience of debaters. And
but that goes back to what I was saying, that I think Joe Rogan is 1995 personified.
Yeah, absolutely.
When he stepped away, I was like, you know, I think I've been thinking about Joe Rogan as sort of as the king of the hobbits in many ways, where he gives the voice piece for the hobbits. Everyone thinks they have this little bit of power because of it's being discussed, and then it goes away. It's quite often more of a pressure valve rather than the necessary pressure washer. It goes into another thing that we've been saying on the live show quite a bit, is that I'm seeing the necessity now of smaller audiences can actually lead to impact rather than some sort of nebulous influence, which is what we've been peddling for a long time. Joe Rogan is essentially some sort of love child of Larry King meets with Johnny Carson. And that worked in the 90s because there was nothing really major going on.
Joe Rogan is a person from the 90s because he believes in the marketplace of ideas. And, like, I will tell you, I in the 90s believed in the marketplace of ideas.
I believed it until like 2014. So
yeah, right. And so when you basically don't, you know, there's sort of two kind of big hobbit copes. Well, there's a lot of hobbit copes, right? A lot of hobbit copes.
We need to get some hobbits to help you move. That's what we really need.
That's the problem. I'm relying on dark elves and you know, they're very highly imaginative, distractible people. And then we have the task rabbits who are, I insist on referring to as rabbits rather than taskers. And because
what you just said made me think of a question, because if I'm looking at Rogan, I'm like, okay, is it news or is it entertainment? And again, we're at this unique nexus point where there's the opportunity for something to be both. And I would take this over the Jon Stewart.
Right,
world.
Right.
It's pro wrestling. It's sports entertainment.
And your question of whether it's news or it's entertainment is really, it's sort of well said, because
that speaks to like what is the purpose of this thing. And if it's basically entertainment, its purpose is to make money, and its purpose is to have Joe driving around in Lamborghinis.
And well, okay, that getting 50 million eyes on a tweet about a debate that's not going to happen fulfills that.
Well, the right? thing is, you know, either you're doing it for money, or you're doing it for power, or you're doing it just for attention. And, you know, doing it for attention is like the worst of these things. It's cringe. Like, you know, nobody should want attention. Attention is terrible. And
well, no one's saying anything true wants mm-hmm. attention, because when you say something true, all of a sudden, if you have the attention, Adam Patrick, a friend of the channel, said this, I'll paraphrase him, but I've said it as well. It's like, if I ever was on Rogan, if I ever found myself on Rogan, I would know that I've massively fucked up. Like, my life is on fire. Like, oh, what have I done? Like, yeah, this is horrible.
Nobody wants any more attention than is necessary to make them money. If you're actually there for power, that's the thing about being news, is that you're there for power.
Yeah. You're also there to sell books. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's face it. The one thing that, you know, we've mentioned Tucker Carlson, and the one thing that Rogan has over Tucker Carlson is that Rogan actually has people on that present solutions. I mean, just having someone like Joel Salatin on a few times to teach people how to start a garden is a bigger solution than, you know, Tucker Carlson is rage porn. He will hide some people who have solutions behind that paywall he used to have with his private podcast on Fox Nation,
Curtis. I remember when I woke up to find
Curtis's
you on
good
that
friend
show,
Charles Haywood. Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm. When I woke up to find you, sorry, Pete, I'll throw it back to you in a sec. But I woke up and I saw that you were on Tucker. I was like, oh, this is exciting. And oh no, what is he doing? Oh no, what is this? Because I also thought Curtis is like, I'm like, oh, does this mean that he's going to be on Rogan? And that was like both semi exciting and also like disastrous at the same time for like the entire dissident rights here. Like, oh no, what does this mean? What is it? Like, suddenly we're going to be like the new libertarian party essentially, but fascist. Yeah. Oh shit. No.
Curtis being on Rogan pissed me off, because it was like,
I would never been on Rogan. I've been in Carlson.
Tucker. Tucker. Yeah. The day that drop was the day I was on Tim Pool, and I'm like, somebody has to outdo me, son of a bitch.
Tim Pool has done well. I mean, you know, like there's a lot more money in the, I mean, you can see why Rogan and Carlson are where they are. And frankly, I do ultimately think they're both porn. But, you know, the problem is that I have a very, I believe, correct, but also very kind of, I have a high bar for calling something a solution. And honestly, my bar is so high that until it involves global regime change, I'm really, really not interested. And so sort of solutions that are like sort of short of that, I'm kind of very biased against, because I can't imagine them happening. Let's use this as a
way to get into solutions. Like, but I'll let you finish your point, but I think there's a good way to.
And so, you know, what's sort of horrible about this situation is like realizing like everything is porn. Everything is all the time porn. Go back to the 80s and look at any like conservative commentary from the 80s. It's all porn. None of it meant anything. You know, frickin' William Bennett. Remember, anyone remember William Bennett and his Book of Virtues? And then it turned out he had a gambling addiction. Okay. I made a really disgusting noise there when I mentioned William Bennett, and right. And so
it was my gag reflex. It's triggering.
Yeah, I know. It's horrifying. You know, I thought you were going to die on the air for the moment. And so. Keith. Right? You know, and so, yeah, basically sort of ascending out of porn and a sounding out of, because basically, you know,
anyone who's selling you porn is a Fed in that sense. Anyone who's basically saying, it's like, you know, my old, you know, analogy, you go to the doctor and the doctor does your numbers and he's like, you've been losing weight. And then he's like the liberal doctor and he's been like, you've been losing weight. That's great. You've never been fitter. And the conservative doctor is like, you look really gaunt. You really haven't been eating. Something strange going on in your body. I'll bet it's cancer. Cancer will do that. Here's some vitamin C. It'll cure your cancer. And I'm just like, no, you were doing so well up until like the tablets, like the little pills you had in your drawer, you know, and like, you know, to tell someone who has cancer that they don't have cancer or to tell them that they don't need chemotherapy is almost the same thing. Mm-hmm. And like, I'm just like, I'm sorry, you know, this town needs an enema. This country needs chemotherapy. Like, that's just how it is. Right. And like, people don't really want to hear that how it is. They want to basically think they can, that they can sort of, you know, get rid of wokeness and somehow keep the State Department and the Department of Justice and the FBI and you know, the teachers union and everything else. But, oh, you're going to get rid of wokeness, right? You know, and I'm just like, dude, you're dreaming. Like, this isn't something that's infected these institutions. Like, that's like saying, like, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union is infected with Marxism or something. Like, it's deranged, right? It's a Marxist party. These are, this is the nature of these institutions. And so when people kind of sort of pussyfoot around with kind of solutions that aren't like solutions at that level, that's when the kind of radical, you know, Leninist Bolshevik in me like starts to be like, what are we even doing here?
Pete, do you have anything to say about that quickly? And then I want to just grab the mic for about 2 minutes to lay out something that I think will get into possible solutions, a groundwork for a conversation about solutions.
Well, I mean, when I say solutions, there's two kinds of solutions. There's
the final ones and the other ones.
the big solution.
I prefer to say permanent answer. But go on.
Well, yeah, I like that, the permanent answer. And then there's also personal solutions while you're waiting for it to
come along. Right,
you know, you've talked about how you have to live like a dissident. You have to live like, you know, you're in occupied territory. And there, the one thing Rogan does have is he has some people on who can help you to do that, help you to teach you how to friggin' have chickens if you want to have chickens
Okay,
so let me try to lay this groundwork. This is something that's been circling around my mind for a while now. And has been inspired by both of you, by the way. So thank you for that. Both of you guys have been integral into this sort of mental transformation of mine. René Girard, the French anthropologist who did a lot of work on memetics and desire, laid down in one of his books that transcendence is the prime human desire, that all humans ultimately desire some form of transcendence. He was referring more into a spiritual, religious form of transcendence, but I think you can bring that down to material. So some of my thing is this, is if we think of transcendence as being the mechanism behind all these things, we could say that progressives in general want to transcend history, to the transhumans want to transcend humanity. Nick Land said this in one of his first chapters books, that Kant is sort of a transcendence of reality itself. What this seems to boil down to for us, especially for the dissident right, is we seem to almost want to transcend chaos into order. And oftentimes where we seem to get screwed up here is that everyone wants their own personal form of order. Like, I want order, but I want my order. I want the order to look like this, and this is the order that I need. I'm at this point now where I'm like, we just need to get order. We need to transcend chaos into order, and any order will do. Now, the caveat to that is I don't believe that fascism or communism or any of those isms are actual order. It's just a veneer of control. That's like the poor man's order is some sort of authoritarian control, which is not what we're really driving at. An actual order is it's like how sickness produces the symptoms of the sickness, and where health produces symptoms of health. So an actual, real, vibrant, correct order will just produce symptoms of good things. We don't have to create those things. They will be self-creating. And that seems to me that the direction that we need to move into. Now, just to build off that and give me two more seconds, one of the things I've been saying on the show for a long time is the ritual and reality are one. These two things are paradoxically feeding themselves into each other. So you can have parallel realities from the Orthodox Christians and Roman Catholics are, if you zoom out, are basically the exact same faith. But if you zoom in, it's quite different. And what differentiates those things, what creates those parallel realities, is our rituals. The differences in those rituals that substantiate that reality. One of the things I see the biggest problems in the dissident right is that we don't have any of our own rituals. We're using old rituals and podcasts. calling back to podcasts or anything. Like people will call back to this Americana stuff that isn't theirs. They think it's theirs, but it isn't. Like Thanksgiving is a ritual in onto itself, but it can be subverted, can be corrupted. And we're looking at the progressive left, wokeism, whatever that is. They have their rituals, and they're substantiating them, and they're forcing them down your throat in many cases. And the response from the right is not sort of like some sort of defensive attack, but it's not to actually substantiate their own rituals, which would create their own reality, which would create a parallel reality to actually say to people, like, here's order. Here's what this looks like. It looks like mm-hmm. this. And this is how you can produce it in your own life continuously. So I've laid all that up. Pete, Curtis, go with that, because I'd love to hear what you have to think. This is what's been infecting my brain for two, three years now. It's like trying to figure that out, because a lot of people on our side, especially in my little pocket of things with a lot of the Orthodox podcasters, everyone talks about this being a spiritual war. I agree with that on its face, but it's like, if this is a spiritual war, then we need to engage it spiritually. If it's ritual, what kind of actual material rituals can we produce here and now? Yeah.
If I can throw one quick thought on top of that, I mean, if you look at, I think something that I see a lot in the right anyways, is that their references, the things that they will hold up as the ideals are always a return. So, okay, well, the American flag, the 50s, that kind of thing. But if you look at the left, they've got a banner, they've got a uniform, they've got parades, they've got all of the markers of a battle regime, flag, right?
They've got a battle flag.
And it's all progressive, sort of future looking. It's new, it's something. Whereas on the right, it's all, in a sense, regressive. It's all a return. Is there a way for the right wing to be innovative? Take it away.
Go ahead, Curtis.
Yeah, all right, let's sort of answer the innovative part first. I tend to like, I feel that there's been, when you look at sort of the modern political audience, it's like very much the same human behavior all over again as compared to the past, but it also has very unique and different qualities. And the sort of the most unique and different quality that you have in the modern audience is that it's basically an audience which, even among conservatives, certainly entirely among liberals, but even among red state people, irony is like completely mass market. And, you know, it's a completely normal thing, like, you know, and the fact that irony is a completely normal thing essentially enables a kind of politics that we haven't really seen before on a mass scale, which is the kind of politics that doesn't say, oh, I'm going to kind of fit into your existing frame and like talk you in this direction, and we're going to have this debate about this issue, but sort of just like uproots you and kind of sweeps you away to a completely different way of thinking and a completely different order. It's like when people are like, oh, fascism, are you a fascist? You know, one of the easiest ways to shut them up is to say simply, was Elizabeth I the fascist? And they're like,
But see, many people would say yes.
Right? Many people would say, they would say, but the thing is, they're not ready. And then you're just like, okay, so fascism gave us Shakespeare. like, you know, fascism, like you're making fascism sound pretty like, yes, is a hard, it's a sort of hard thing to defend. And they're immediately on sort of weak ground because they actually don't know. They've never really thought about that question. And they sort of don't have this, you're in this, asking to declare Elizabeth the First, who's clearly a monarch, a fascist, you know, sort of requires them to collect, you know, sort of separate their like Renfair, Elizabethan equals right. good brain.
Well,
to,
she like, had monarchy, power.
Monarchy equals bad. And it's just like, you know, you freeze the circuits and a little bit of smoke comes out of one or both ears. Right. And, you know, that's like, you need to, when you basically take someone who's sort of been conditioned for irony, like, you know, one of the ways I watched the ascent of irony in American popular culture is just simply by Super Bowl ads. And so the first Super Bowl I watched, I remember it well, was Super Bowl 17. And you watch the commercials on like Super Bowl 17. What are they up to now? Like 54 or something, you know? 70, 85.
I'd have to watch.
I don't know. But the thing is, it basically, you know, the straight up hard sell.
Sorry,
ad.
I have this vision of a young Curtis Yarvin putting down his Deleuze book to watch the sports ball, and it's an endearing image.
I mean, you can figure out what year that was, but the you know, so sure, sports ball, right? And the, you know, at that time when I was a kid, you know, just to date myself in the '80s, right? Everything was a hard sell. Like, and now everything is ironic, except mm-hmm. that politics is still relying on the hard sell. Mm-hmm. And like the hard sell actually sucks. It's not a great way to sell. It's not a great way to get engagement. It's not a great way to excite people. You can, of course, fall back on these, like, you know, sort
that
of
explains my Twitter.
You can fall back on this, like, oh, you know, everybody loves a uniform and a flag and a cause and all of that. You know, that's still kind of true. At the same time, people are just like much less violent than they used to, you know, except Pete's ex-fiance, of course. But the they're much less violent than they used to be. And sorry, Pete. And they're willing to do like much less, you know, physically in the world. That's not just about, that affects like voting, that affects like, you know,
all like, people,
right? Yeah, sure. And so, you know, the possibilities of an ironic politics, I think, run very, very deep. And there's somehow a connection between a kind of irony uprooting you from all of this political bullshit that's like been sort of hammered into your head since you were 6 years old, and basically saying, what if it's all crap? What if George Washington and the cherry tree are just as much crap as like the Soviet Union? And like saying, no, actually we need to pull it all up. And, you know, that traditionally would be the last thing that these like red state Americans would think of, mm-hmm. with their God and their guns and their constitution and, you know, all of this stuff. Right. And realizing that it's those things that have actually been holding them back, and that if they simply embrace like mere pure nihilism, they can win just by snapping their fingers, is like, that's ironic. And like, people love irony these days. And I think there's a sense in which Trump had this air of like irony. He had this air of like, I'm just going to break the frame, but he didn't have any kind of vision of a different order that was attached to that frame breaking. Mm-hmm. And I feel, you know, the sort of the, like this kind of different order isn't something that you sort of gradually think yourself into as a people. It's more like you open the door for it as a people, and then a tremendous creative force rushes through that door. And that's why, you know, sort of Napoleon is one of the best examples of like, essentially France was effed, and Napoleon sort of received the mandate to completely reconstruct and like to build a different France. And he did. And he changed everything. He recodified the laws. Like, you know how badly like American law needs to like basically a rewrite from the ground up. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Right. You know, who could ever possibly do that? Actually, it's simple, but it's only simple if you've just swept away all other authority. And this idea of basically the only way to get to an order, which makes sense. And yeah, as you pointed out, it's not necessary to be too particular about that order, right? You know, it's actually, there's a lot of possible orders that make sense. You know, you as an Orthodox person, you know, if you had to live in a Pentecostalist religious state, you'd be like, okay, at least fine. We're not working, we're worshiping transsexual Satan, you know, right? And fine, whatever. Like, you know, it's just ritual.
I bring up the Singapore model quite a bit, where mm-hmm. I was like, you know, I don't necessarily would want to live in Singapore, although I've never been there. I only judge them from what I heard. Like, I'm not, I don't like East Asians. It's a whole thing.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
Totally
legitimate perspective, but go on.
Please. But at the same time, I look at their model. Yeah. I look at their model and go, not that I think you can ever export anything perfectly, because that's the misnomer of liberalism anyways. But I'm looking at that going, look, they solve for all these problems. Now, maybe public canings in the middle of the street isn't the only way to solve that problem. But what if it is? Yeah. And they don't have rape.
It's an option.
So it's an option. And as a father of a young daughter, it's like, yeah, you do have these questions and you do have these concerns. And I put these things as a priori statements, where it's like, well, civilization be damned. My own personal preferences I've asked this open question quite often on Twitter and other spaces, is that would you select for a system that disenfranchises you in the moment, but does solve for all these problems? Because if you say no, then you don't really see these as problems. You see them as inconveniences or things that are like, rape. Yeah, I kind of wish they didn't exist, but whatever, right? If you're going to get serious, then let's get serious. And I think that goes back to the whole ritual thing, is how do we start to, and I'll throw this to you, Pete. I know we're coming up on an hour and a half. I don't know why I don't want to keep you guys for too much longer. What's that story?
I do have to go soon, but okay. Let's finish this up.
We'll do closing thoughts, because I think we've thrown a lot at the audience, and we can always continue this at some other date.
Sure.
Just realized I was muted. Let me throw this at you, Jason, just to finish on that thought that you were saying, because maybe instead of saying let's rewrite the Constitution, it could be really easy things. Like I've said, why don't we just bring back public lashings and stocks?
Well,
hit it from that, you know, like make it rudiment so simple you can't fuck it up, and maybe the effects will go
sure up, but like who's this we? Like you're basically sort of imagining an order which is the present order,
like a mayor,
but also excludes this other thing, which is like really not unlike imagining my idea of like changing all the street names to Robert E. Lee. How would you have to change the system to make structurally to make that possible?
Let's put it this way. If starting from our position right now, if you had the power to suddenly put to install stocks and guillotines and all the rest of it, you wouldn't need to. Because if you had that, if you had that actual cachet and power to actually do that, you wouldn't need to do that. You'd have this amazing power. And it's like, if that's all you ended up doing with that amazing amount of power, to go from where we are now to being able to have that power to people to go, well, I guess we're just guillotining people now, right?
Yeah.
That increase in power is so immense
that it doesn't even make the question make sense. Like, you know, because basically the idea doesn't make sense, because anything sort of having the power to implement that idea would have the power to implement so many other things that, you know, you're asking
if you had the power,
essentially.
Yeah, but then maybe I'm misstating the question. The power exists. I'm talking about simplifying the criminal code. I mean, there are people saying, well, you can steal anything you want up to $1,000 and we're not going to prosecute you. I'm saying, well, what if you, instead of doing nothing, you give them a really simple, really basic, really public punishment. And maybe that just it's like raising kids. If you establish really easy rules, those trend upwards into the competition.
Yeah, but you're looking at an endpoint where we're not even, we're so far from that endpoint that it's ridiculous to even.
I mean,
consider.
You know, so like
we have to
so,
generate that much more power.
Yeah.
Energy.
So if you're right, basically, if you're generating that much power, basically, that's a level of power that actually enables you to look at the human beings who are shoplifting. Are they loot crews? Are they like addicts? Are they like, who are these people? You know, they should not be doing this. And probably there are many other things that these people should not be doing. And probably doing these things is not particularly good for them as well as for the people around them. And like, you know, yes, it is absolutely, you know, the role of the state to sort of lay a hand on these people's shoulders and say, thou shalt not loot, you know, but
like, look how bad things had to get in El Salvador for the will. It's an accurate term. It's linguistically inaccurate, but I'll just use it as a thing to the necessity to generate that much energy for what's his name in El Salvador to put everyone in jail like that. Is immense. Like if you look at in terms of factors of power, we're in the West, collectively in the West, I'll throw Australia, Canada, and all the European, right.
Well,
all
yes,
the Eurozone
as
in there.
Far as I understand, he rewrote the Constitution and broke and clamped down on
right.
Petty,
we
petty
we can't
theft,
even crack right? one tenth of that power.
Right. No, not a hundredth. Right. And so it's like basically, you know, you have this whole mechanism of Republican ideas and Republican institutions, and they're all basically meant to generate power against the powers that be, and they generate really low levels of power. And you're just like, how can 75 million people acting together be so weak? And like, the answer is like, it's almost hilarious that they're so weak. If you had, you know, 75 million people and you had a chip in all of their heads and you could tell them exactly what to do, you wouldn't need 75 million people. You would need 5 million people. No regime could withstand that.
Or 10,000. Right?
You know,
10,000 people, 10,000 people in varying parts of the hierarchy, all desiring order, like collectively order. And I'm saying order, like I'm not even specifying. I think 10,000 people at different points of the hierarchy, all mimetically inducing that in that desire, will suddenly self-generate it. It will begin to self-generate, and then all you need to do is start to harness it. And then once we get to that point, well, fuck it. Then we can sit around here and
well, I mean, the thing, you know, to get back to Rogan, basically, the thing that there are many things that are difficult to do that, you know, sort of without having state power. Locking up all, you know, the gang members in LA is certainly one of them. But there are many things that is possible to do without having state power. And one of them is to basically create an information system that is much more powerful and reliable than the powers that be. And like, if you're thinking about it in terms of like, how many subscribers do I have, or even how do I like influence the marketplace of ideas, versus, you know, thinking about it in terms of like, how do I generate more power? Like, sorry. Mm-hmm. An electrical issue, speaking of power, but is just like thinking in that way, in that really, really simple way, rather than sort of thinking about like policy fixes as though Norman Rockwell was in the room, is like really, I mean, I like as a Norman Rockwell idea, I really like your idea of like flogging. Other smart people have proposed this. Historically very common. I think it makes a great deal of sense. But the thing is that it's basically like, it's like I see as like a programmer, I see this enormous code base that needs rewriting. And I'm basically to say, okay, this line in that should be that line. I'm like, no, actually, there will be no counterpart for that line in the next code base, right? So it's like when you basically, when you sort of have these one-off ideas and you're like, well, this could work, it sort of doesn't, like, you're not leading people toward this kind of thing where they're just uprooted completely from their kind of existing frame and kind of flung into a new frame. And I think that sort of getting people to accept this kind of just heavy DMT red pill rush is like, you know, much easier than it's ever been before, even for boomer conservatives. And like, you see basically the popularity of Trump against his, like, you know, sort of more normie, like DeSantis is on paper in some ways more radical than Trump. And yet mm-hmm. Trump is a frame breaker and DeSantis is not a frame breaker. And you see who's winning and who's losing.
Yeah. Pete.
Well, I think the most important thing when we're thinking about total regime change is after that, you still have this spirit of the age, whatever anyone wants to call it, that is going to be infesting people's minds. And they're still they're still going to be wanting to go back to at least I think people, there are a lot of people out there who dream about what it would look like if all this was overturned, yet they haven't changed their thinking, so instinctively they're going to want to go back. And, you know, it's why I think, you know, like when I talked to Paul Gottfried recently, he said, yeah, he said, I think the only thing that solves this is like real right-wing authoritarianism. And that's the one thing that can break people out of that liberal mindset, because if right-wing, if they're seeing right-wing authoritarianism on TV, they're going to be worried about that. But also if they see it and it's directed at people that they look at now and they see as enemies, they're like, oh, this is probably the way forward. But also those people who don't immediately react to that, they're going to react to the fact that something new is happening. And we have to, if that were to happen, you also have to remember that there are going to be people who are going to want to go back.
Mm-hmm. So somehow there's a trick out there, and it's kind of hard to imagine from where we sit, where you have a regime that right-wingers think of as right-wing authoritarianism and left-wingers think of as left-wing authoritarianism, and is actually sort of neither in a way, and is kind of above and transcends really both of those things. And the, like, that's really hard to picture from where we are, but in some ways that's kind of the closest way to describe what Napoleon did in France. And the, like,
yeah, we've been living in disorder for so long, and we've been living in some sort of
right.
one form of chaos for so long that we've accepted chaos, that anything that is even approaching true order looks authoritarian and tyrannical.
And it looks, and people can only envision them, they can sort of only envision it in terms of the chaos of having someone else's order imposed on them, which is always chaotic. If you basically take a bunch of, like, you know, like a thriving Eastern Orthodox community, and you ask them to live, you know, like African Americans in the ghetto, you're forcing something really a false order on them, and vice versa. And so, you know, you basically, in, it's especially problematic because you have, like it or not, North America is not an ethno state, and you have all of these different cultural tropes and traditions in them, as well as this kind of like mass, you know, mashed up void of like modernity, and like taking that and kind of reducing it to an order that would make sense to like Elizabeth the First is an immense task. But, you know, would I be unsurprised if it, that task involved a little flogging? No, I would not be surprised if that task involved a little flogging.
Let's end this here. I could look, I think we could usually go another 3-4 hours on this, but let's put a pin in this. Let's pick this up, because I think where we're ending here is and things to think about individually or on our different shows or collectively if we get together and do this again is willing that desire for order and decent rituals for the right, like we'll call the right, the dissident right, not the other thing that we've seen, yeah, yes, that we seem to be involved in, not Kiev.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
perfect. But,
maybe we can start thinking about that kind of concept of like, how do we substantiate those rituals that people will want to partake in, that we can partake in ourselves, that we can easily show. You know, prayer is the easiest one, but I want to not be religious. I don't think we have to necessarily have any religious context to it, because Thanksgiving and all these other things are also rituals. Baseball and football, these were all rituals for America for a long time. I think we have to abandon those to a certain extent, or either abandon them or reform them in some way. But I think there's room to create new rituals that once presented to our friends, then we begin to build this reality that is now a parallel reality. And then we can go, this is what we built. And your transition is, I'm not asking you to go step off the pier into nothing, into the void. I'm not presenting you a theory. I'm presenting you something that you can engage in on your daily life on a daily basis. That is good.
Intangible. You can enter the church of Joe Rogan as it was, but not the Joe Rogan that exists, the ideal Joe Rogan.
Conceptual Joe Rogan. The meta Joe Rogan.
All right.
The meta
right.
Joe Rogan, yeah.
Joe Rogan plus NewsGuard.
I will say this. I will say this to the audience. Thank you so much, guys. I'll let you do your plugs. I have subscribed to both Pete Substack and Curtis's Substack. Curtis, I think you're the reason I got onto Substack in the first place.
It's a great product.
So please plug your way, and I would ask anyone who's watching this, either live or in future, to please give some money over to Pete and Curtis. Reward people for doing the Lord's work, and we will see it. We will see you guys later. So, yeah, go ahead, plugs. Yeah.
All right. Check me out at graymirror.substack.com. That's Gray with an A, the American way, and look forward to the first paywalled installment of my next book soon. And Pete
Quinones Show and PeteSubstack.com.
And of course, we also find us over at 2Bit Podcast at Substack.com. You can join our locals page. We're going to be expanding ways and finding new ways for you guys to support the channel if you wish to. And of course, we thank you very much for paying attention to us. It's always a pleasure and an honor and very humbling at the same time. Sorry, yes. Mark.
I just wanted to thank both of our guests again. You guys are inspirations to both of us. This is really special to have not just both of you on, but both of you on together is remarkable for us, and we couldn't be happier to have hosted you. And we'd love
stop
to do it again.
Gushing, Mark. You're gonna embarrass. Where
I'm at, and my thought wouldn't be possible unless somebody who said they were a former libertarian, and this is why you're no longer a libertarian, wrote stuff when Ron Paul was running for president the first time. And I was able to go back and read and be like, oh yeah, that's why this thing doesn't work. Okay, good. Yeah, there we go.
All right. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Super fun. All right. Take care. Bye.
Take care. Bye. All right, guys. We
are we what?